Good evening. We're checking firstly that the microphones are working, and they do seem to be working perfectly well. Stan Cohen has been linked to the school for over 30 years. He came first as a graduate student who pursued work centered originally and rather mysteriously, as his supervisor told us on more than one occasion, on the vandalization of floral clocks. In time and quite adventitiously, his research came to focus on the dramatic events of the Mods and Rockers of Clacton and Margate, and he must have been one of the very few outsiders who was actually pleased to have been present at what were afterwards described as riots, although whether they were riots indeed was the leitmotif of his thesis, which was published as Folk Devils and Moral Panics, and that very title injected two new enduring terms into the English language. He was part of a generation, is part of a generation, of young Turks associated with the new wave of deviancy theory that met regularly at the University of York, and whose first papers he edited as Images of Deviance. And some of those young Turks are here today, hoary old veterans, who will meet afterwards for a reunion. The celebrations go on and on. After the LSE, Stan toured the world. He went to Enfield, to Durham, to Colchester, to Jerusalem and Santa Barbara, and is now returned as a visiting centennial professor. Intellectually, his work, as most of you will know, has been marked always by two strong interlaced themes, by a preoccupation with the state and its power to define, to segregate, and to coerce on the one hand, and secondly, on the other, with the parts played by the criminologist as the state's critic, spectator, or accomplice. And in his work, criminological subject and object, observer and observed, have always been fused in confrontation. It's with great pleasure that I ask him to deliver the LSE Centenary Lecture on Crime and Politics, Spot the Difference.
Thanks very much, Paul. I would like to thank the Law Department and the Sociology Department and the Mannheim Center for inviting me. And thanks to Paul for his generous introduction. As we know, academic introductions are not usually very generous. There's the famous cartoon of the two old professors in the Harvard Faculty Club. The one says to the other, OK, he discovered fire, but what's he done since then? My talk tonight is going to be about the relationships between crime and politics. It includes a slightly self-indulgent subtext, which is a glance at what happened to some of the ideas from the new criminology movement that some of us, as Paul said, including many of us present in the hall now, favored 30 years ago here in the milieu of LSE in the mid-60s. I start with two texts, not texts with a capital T and the literary postmodernist sense, but texts in the old-fashioned ways that rabbis and mullahs and priests used texts. The first is very familiar to criminologists, a much-quoted passage from one of the most influential books of the period, the American sociologist David Matz's Becoming Deviant, a text resonating the culture of the 60s and conceived by Matz when he was a visitor here in 1987-88. With typical irony, he records the uncoupling of 20th century criminology from politics. Among their most notable accomplishments, he writes, the criminological positivists succeeded in what would seem the impossible. They separated the study of crime from the theory and workings of the state. My second text is less familiar to criminologists, but more to everyone else. It's from John le Carré's recent novel, The Night Manager. Here's the scene. The Cold War is over. There's no more pretense at ideology. History's come to an end. The new enemy is the callous international cartels of drugs and illegal arms and money laundering. Burr, the agent for the new revamped British intelligence services, now deals not with the old politics, but the new crime. And in one scene, he's trying to recruit our hero to help bring to justice a particularly nasty dealer in illegal arms and drugs. Burr was talking about justice, I quote from le Carré. When I get to run the world, I'm going to hold the Nuremberg Trials Part 2. I'm going to get all the arms dealers and shit scientists and all the smooth salesmen who push the crazies one step further than they thought of going because it's good for business, and all the lying politicians and lawyers and accountants and bankers. I'm going to put them in the dock to answer for their lives. And you know what they'll say? If we hadn't done it, somebody else would have. And you know what I'll say? I'll say, oh, I see. If you hadn't raped the girl, some other fellow would have raped her. And that's your justification for rape. Noted. I'll take these two quotes to track two somewhat different stories, two apparently opposite but perhaps complementary ways to conceive of the relationship between crime and politics. I'll derive from Matz's quote, or rather the uses to which it was put, a brief sociology of knowledge tale, how the first wave of critical criminology from the mid-60s tried to restore the political into the criminological discourse, to bring the state back in. I'll list five ways in which this was done, and then trace the later trajectory of these ideas. I'll derive from the John le Carré quote a more complicated and speculative point, that somewhere there, in what some of us still rather quaintly refer to as the real world, transformations are occurring in the way in which political conflicts are understood and happen, transformations which call into question the boundary between crime and politics in much more radical ways than we could have imagined. Okay, first, part of what I call the political question in crime, politics and the criminological discourse. As I always tell my PhD students, when in doubt, make a list. And this is the list. A list of five political dimensions of crime and deviance that were pursued over these years. First, the first and most obvious project was to understand the history and status of the criminological discipline itself in political terms. The evolution of criminological theory from the classical to the positivist school was now located in the broader political economy of the modern state. Oversimplified as some of these earlier accounts might have been, their general drift remains valid. The impact of Foucault led to a more sophisticated view of the role of criminology in the broader project of governmentality, but these revisionists look for more refined links between knowledge and power rather than returning to old-fashioned internalistic intellectual history. The question of the current political status of criminology, as opposed to its hidden political genealogy, has turned out to be more complicated. The original choices, though, between correctionalism, detached scholarship, liberal underdog sympathy, and radical social change still remain. The new left realist criminologists might have renounced the outsider status in favor of relevance, but this is hardly a retreat from politics. The dominant paradigm, now much more managerial and depoliticized than ever, but not simply positivist and not at all very liberal, can still be challenged in political terms. The second form of politicization is obvious, non-controversial, and hardly needs any comment. This is the direction indicated by Matz's reminder about Leviathan, the power of the state to criminalize. The question of criminalization merely drew criminological scholarship into the mainstream of sociological and historical inquiry. Studies about the origins of law, the rule of law, or particular laws, became framed in terms of classic social theory or the new history of E.P. Thompson. In all cases, crime became no longer the taken-for-granted construct of positivism, but the object of political deconstruction. The same applies to the broader revisionist history of social control structures and ideologies. The juvenile court, the prison, the mental hospital, therapeutic professions, alcohol and drug professions, prohibition, and so on, all these became subject to historical scrutiny. Foucault changed the model of analysis, feminism created a new agenda, but the political drift remains. The importance of the political dimensions of law enforcement became taken for granted. You don't have to be a critical criminologist to study discrimination or police discretion or sentencing and so on. The continued salience of race, class, and gender differences, the renewal of the underclass debate, the undermining of the welfare state, these have all made the politics of criminal justice even more relevant, and I'll be returning to this. A third and far more complicated notion was the one that soon gave the whole enterprise of politicization a bad name. This was the attempt to rescue the criminal from the positivist assumptions of determinism and pathology. Crime became either the expression, symbol, or equivalent of political resistance, or the product of the political order of capitalism. Let me say a bit about both of these. The first, the criminal as political actor. The short-lived notion of the criminal as rebel and crypto-political actor was seldom found in its pure form. This was, though, an identifiable residue from some of the more anarchist and romantic cultures of the 60s. A new form of essentialism appeared, an idealistic inversion of positivist imagery. At the extreme were projections of the criminal as outlaw, hero, and Robin Hood, the identification of prisons as incubators of revolution, the Marcusean and Fanonist celebration of liberatory violence. In a less extreme sense, crime and deviance came to be seen as more rational, meaningful, and intentional than was allowed by agents of social control or their academic servants. Conventional accounts were seen to mask and mystify the essentially political meaning of action. So the new fully social deviant emerged, busy redistributing private property, busy attacking the Protestant work ethic by getting stoned, busy sabotaging factory machines to reassert control over alienated labor, busy in new subcultural theory magically resolving the class contradictions of post-war Britain, busy on the football terraces protesting the transformation of community into commercial spectacle, busy destroying conventional sexual norms, even busy as schizophrenics in undermining the lethal gas chamber, as it was called, of the family. As some of these more extreme versions were called, homage to catatonia. Now, it's easy enough to caricature, as I have, these ideas, and note the absence of much supporting evidence for this political consciousness. It was understandable that later criminologists found these ideas embarrassing for ignoring the suffering of victims and the particular vulnerability of women, the elderly, the poor, and ethnic minorities. It's unfortunate, however, that the denunciation of these romantic excesses led to a lack of sensitivity to the political edge that ordinary crime might either take or be attributed with. The question of when crime can be seen as political remains as opaque as ever. So does the original metrics of four possibilities. At the level of the phenomenon itself, politicization means the historical change from normatively deviant to self-consciously political narratives, for example, the transformation of homosexuality into gay liberation, while the opposite, criminalization, means the use of traditional criminal tactics and styles in various forms of political marginality. And at the level of social reaction or interpretation, politicization means the use of political labels and theories to explain criminal events and actors, while the opposite, criminalization or depoliticization, means the allocation of political acts into criminal categories, for example, through terminology such as thugs, or bandits, or gangs, or hooligans, or crazies. The causal theory of capitalism as criminogenic had a slightly longer shelf life. The original attempts to adapt traditional Marxist concepts to explain working class property crime and violence virtually disappeared, but in vocabulary only. The conceptual base of liberal criminology in the United States and rough realism in Britain remained similar. Their causal theory is just a political version of the old subcultural theory, and more especially of the thesis of relative deprivation. The triumph of free market economies, deepening socioeconomic inequalities, and in the middle of this, the discovery of the new reasoning criminal, have all drawn attention to the criminogenic features of post-industrial societies. In post-communist countries, these corrosive effects have only just started. So far from politics being removed by this latest round of the end of ideology, the lethal combination of free market dogma with law and order politics exposes the political dimension of ordinary crime more clearly than the blurred mirror images of East-West communism, capitalism ever did. Now I'm going to expand later on some rather bizarre twists that these two subjects took. Let me anticipate two of them. The first, the original countercultural project of endowing the deviant with choice and rationality didn't lead very far, but the attack on liberal positivism from the right and from the managerial center succeeded in an astonishing way. Criminologists working for institutions like the Home Office discovered, to use the title of a book by Ron Clark, one of the school's leading proponents, the new reasoning criminal. We now have the criminal as a consumer, as market actor, somebody who not only has more rationality than the determined creatures of sociological inquiry, but has nothing but choice and rationality. Disembodied from all social context, deprivation, urban dislocation, unemployment are airily listed as background factors. They take their risks, assess their opportunities, have their targets hardened, and stay away from others' defensible spaces. The second unexpected twist is to find that the use of criminological language in the political realm, depoliticization as I called it, has to be taken more seriously. This is not a mere ideological ploy anymore, but a credible vocabulary to capture certain social changes, and I'll be returning to these. Now, number four. Potentially the most far-reaching of the original attempts to reconnect crime with politics was extending the definition of crime from its narrow legal base to include wider social harms, injuries, and injustices. and this attempt was captured in the resonant 60s notion of the crimes of the powerful. Crime in the streets was mystification, real crime lay elsewhere in the depredations committed by corporations and the state. Now, this claim was only potentially rather than actually far-reaching. Early attempts to define the concept of state crime failed, and so was the attempt to link it to human rights violations, because they were too woolly and polemical. The criteria for social injury and harm were correctly invoked, and human rights abuse, but this led to a rhetorical coupling of the obvious cases, such as genocide, with the general injustices of economic exploitation, racism, sexism, and so on. Sutherland's famous question, is white-collar crime crime, can be much more persuasively translated into the question, is state crime crime, if we stick to the terrain of formally recognized state violations of human rights. We might still want to use the term crime as a rhetorical device to describe any forms of social institutionalized social injustice, but the terrain of human rights violations offers clearer criteria for regarding genocide, mass political killings, torture, extrajudicial killings, and so on, as criminal. These are illegalities as defined by both domestic and international law. Terms like crimes against humanity or war crimes have clear legal reference. There's an apparatus of enforcement and punishment, however weak it is in practice. In any event, for whatever reasons, too vague an extension of the term crimes of the powerful, but also the perverse blindness of Anglo-American criminology to what's happening anywhere else in the world, this particular linkage between crime and politics all but disappeared. Now certain external developments, the ascendance of the human rights movement, and internal changes, the preoccupation with victims, have made the human rights linkage much more visible, and I'll be coming back to that subject. Number five now, the last one. That other resonant 60s slogan, the personal is political, was destined for a less uninterrupted life than the slogan, crimes of the powerful. Originating politically in the civil, gay, and women's rights movement, and theoretically in the loosely Reichian left Freudianism of the time, this idea was meant to convey two rather different meanings. The first, less significant these days, was the politics of authenticity. Personal life should be led according to political conviction. The second, very much the dominant voice of current political and sexual correctness, was to transpose personal and public matters into the political and public realms. And the women's movement became the apotheosis of both these meanings. Gender, sexuality, reproduction, body language, intimate relationships were politicized in both theoretical and practical terms. In the world of theory, this led to new ways of conceptualizing power, of linking masculinity with violence, and of deconstructing the boundaries between public and private space. In the world of social control practice, this led to new laws or new systems of enforcement to deal with male sexualized violence, discrimination, pornography, sexual harassment, speech codes, and so on. The astonishing growth of the victim movement is a logical extension of this strand. In one sense, this is a victory for C. Wright Mills's original vision of sociology as something that converts private troubles into public issues. In another sense, as I'll suggest, the culture of victimization is a troubling defeat for democratic politics. And I'll move on to the second part. And the second part of my lecture reverses the search, looking not for the political dimensions of traditional criminological and sociology of deviance matters, but for the ways in which the question of crime, la question criminale as it was called, runs through the substance and discourse of contemporary political life. Now, some of these are obvious and beyond dispute. Others suggest transformations as yet unclear in how political conflicts occur and become understood and become regulated. But they blur the boundary between crime and politics in forms far more paradoxical and disturbing than criminologists ever imagined. And this might lead us to prefer, and this is to anticipate my conclusion, the opposite direction, separating rather than linking crime and politics. The first direction, already obvious 30 years ago and hardly open to dispute, is the embedding of the crime problem into standard political discourse. The perception of crime as a political threat and the emergence of distinctive political ideologies about crime, crudely the conservative and the liberal, can of course be traced back to the 19th century. It was not predictable in the 60s, however, that the crime problem would so come to dominate the political rhetoric of Western democracies. I don't think we fully appreciated the reasons for the potency of law and order issues in election campaigns and the weight of criminal justice policy in the shaping of Thatcher's Britain and Reagan's America, as well as other European countries. Even its critics, or supposedly academic students, have to locate themselves in the new discourse of public order. British universities like Leicester now have centers for the study of public order. This offers an MA in public order, whatever that is. The center's interests, I quote now from a glossy pamphlet which also boasts of its close ties with the private security industry, are listed as riots and public disorder, crime and punishment, policing, crime prevention, race and ethnic relations, and inner city issues. Such political location of standard criminological subject is now taken for granted. Now, all this raises many issues, each deserving at least its own lecture. Now, let me just raise a few. The constructionist triangle that we're talking about here has three corners. In the first corner, there's the actual incidence, severity, and risk of criminal victimization. In the second corner, there's the public perception of the seriousness of the crime problem. Crime, as we know, is increasingly ranked as a more important social problem than unemployment, healthcare, nuclear risk, environmental damage, and so on. And in the third corner, there's the rhetorical manipulation of the crime problem in media and political discourse. Now, what is the congruence between these three corners? Is this public discourse really about crime, or rather a metaphor for expressing a wider sense of social dislocation and disorder? For Britain and America, there can be little doubt that the new punitiveness, boot camps, death penalty, longer prison sentences, three strikes and you're out, the return of the chain gang, are not simply driven by increases in crime. But then what exactly does account for the new politics of law and order? Away from Western democracies, the politics of crime have taken on other forms. The fear of violent and property crime in South Africa, both during and after apartheid, has always been real, as well as a screen for wider political unease. In the former Soviet Union and post-communist states of Eastern Europe, variants of street and organized crime have been reconstructed as political problems. Western-style crime, mafia killings, protection rackets, street violence, is now at the center of public imagery about Russia. Political discourse is full of law and order talk. The most popular pistol sold in what is called a gun boutique in Warsaw is called Miami, after the Miami Vice TV series. A statement from the Russian leadership after the Lisvayev killing in Moscow in March is worth quoting. A series of bandit actions and murders committed here have provoked the well-founded alarm of society. These crimes can be described as a manifestation of terror, as a challenge to the course of democratic reform, and to the establishment of a civil society, unquote. Remember, of course, that terms like banditry and hooliganism were precisely those used during the old regime to discredit legitimate political opposition. In other words, politics was criminalized. Now, crime is politicized. In other parts of the world, the problems of crime, urban violence and drugs, combined with police corruption and inefficiency, have led to direct political involvement by the state armed forces rather than the police. In Brazil in 1994, for example, the military took over the shanty towns of Rio from a totally corrupt local police which had lost control to drug gangs. The urban guerrilla warfare described by Rio's archbishop referred not to political conflict, but to the power of drug gangs to close shops, schools, and influence election campaigns. Under similar circumstances elsewhere, as I'll come back to, lawlessness and crime have so destroyed the social fabric that the state itself has withdrawn. Observers from West Africa, for example, predict that private security businesses and in the ex-communist world, urban mafias will become better equipped than municipal police forces to grant physical protection to local inhabitants. A recent observer in Mexico nicely describes the combination of endless legal rules and the government's total inability to enforce them as virtual legality. Even in more stable social democracies, the political resonance of the old war against crime metaphor has become stronger. Many large American cities are routinely described as ungovernable as a result of violence, drugs, and a breakdown of policing and social services. The 1994 declaration of a state of emergency by the mayor of Washington was seen as an appropriate strategy for what a local journalist called a pocket of the third world dropped into the United States, a one-party state plagued by daily gun violence, racial tension, and financial chaos. Now, under these circumstances, as I'll note in another context, The war against crime is not just a metaphor, but describes the actual displacement of techniques and personnel from the Cold War military apparatus to domestic law enforcement. In June 1994, the National Institute of Justice in Washington, the most important government bureaucracy dealing with crime, convened a major conference entitled Law Enforcement Technology for the 21st Century. The conference's subtitle was The Less Than Lethal Alternative. This reflects the priorities assigned to the army chiefs who were present and private corporations to develop such weapons as non-lethal laser guns and other weapons of pacification. The Mitsubishi sales pitch for the non-lethal laser gun that's being developed by army industries for domestic pacification is something between a gun and persuasion. David Garland from Edinburgh has recently given a nuanced analysis of the politics of punitive crime control policy. During the last 30 years, high crime rates have become a normal social fact in countries like Britain. Despite its wholly uneven distribution, crime is accepted as an aberration. Crime is accepted not as an aberration, but a routine part of consciousness, an everyday risk to be managed, like air pollution and road traffic. There's little confidence in the government's ability to solve or fight the problem. What Garland calls the crisis in penal modernism lies in the perceived normality of high crime rates and the long obvious to any honest criminologist at least, limitations of the criminal justice agencies to do anything about this. The result is an erosion of one of the foundational myths of modern society, that the sovereign state is capable of providing security, law and order, and crime control. So, new modes of governance develop, for example, first increasing involvement of the private sector in policing, security, and even incarceration. Second, the model of crime as a risk to be calculated by offender and potential victim, or as an accident to be avoided, rather than a moral aberration which needs special explanation. Third, a supply-side policy which makes citizens responsible for crime through publicity campaigns, self-help groups, volunteers, projects like Neighborhood Watch and Crime Concern. And fourth, the managerial ethos of performance indicators, which judges criminal justice agencies by completely self-referential measures, which have nothing at all to do with reducing crime. So expectations are scaled down, and the message is that crime control is beyond the state. But why then the punitive rhetoric, and why the fact that the hard core of the traditional system keeps on expanding? Garland suggests that at the same time as its administrative institutions have been devising these managerial strategies with their limited aim of risk management, so the political arm of the state swings into episodes of hysterical and populist denial of these very limitations. In the face of evidence that crime does not really respond to severe sentences, new police powers, or greater use of imprisonment, governments still appeal to the old law and order rhetoric. The short-term political costs of admitting the futility of these methods are unacceptable. So we have the sudden and volatile shifts of political mood, responses to public feeling and rage of rage and frustration after a particularly disturbing crime, cynical manipulations of the symbols of government power, policies that deliberately increase prison populations. So the show of punitive force is used to repress any acknowledgments of the state's systemic inability to control crime. State sovereignty over crime is simultaneously denied, transferred to private security operations or the responsible citizen, and symbolically reasserted. Number two, again, like the first, a list. Political corruption is as old as political power, yet the post-Watergate era has seen an unprecedented and uninterrupted series of public scandals about corrupt government in Western democracies. There might be little in common in such diverse events as Watergate itself and Iran-Contra in the United States, the Scott inquiry and regular exposures of government sleaze in Britain, or the Tangentopoli scandals in Italy. In some cases, criminal activities, bribery, corruption, embezzlement, theft, were used for personal greed, in others for party political gain, and yet others to subvert basic legal and constitutional norms. In all cases, though, public perception, aided by more vigilant media, has raised new questions of legitimacy. This is more, it seems to me, than the old familiar sequence of muckraking expose followed by the cynical view that all politicians are crooked. There are new elements in Iran-Contra and the official corruption which has totally reshaped Italian politics and reverberated into a major corruption scandal, even in the quiet democracy of Belgium and reaching the highest reaches of NATO, which seem to be quite new. And the three-way tie-up between business, political parties, and organized crime has now stretched to a fourth corner, separatist and terrorist groups. And the scale has also become more global. 2 weeks ago, the Secretary General of Interpol, with a little bit of hype and rhetoric, noted that it's becoming difficult to draw a clear line between what he called a normal political business corruption, note that he used the phrase normal political business corruption, and hardcore organized criminal activity. Now, this rhetoric aside, the institutions of criminal justice seem to me to be involved now, as never before, in regulating and inquiring into the standards of public life. Third, international criminal organization. Here I come to the specific subject raised by my Le Carre quote. The existence of international criminal organization is, again, not new in itself. Studies of the mafia and international drug markets have long picked up allegations about government connections, for example, through security services such as the CIA, and concepts such as narco-terrorism suggest yet other links between crime and politics. I think we've not begun to grasp, however, even begun to comprehend, the scope of these new transnational networks based on drug cartels, illegal arms dealing, money laundering, and political manipulation. There's a worldwide movement of capital and goods uncontrolled and uncontrollable by the modern state. Its criminal strands are obvious. After oil, the second largest international commodity traded in the world is drugs. In the ex-Soviet Union, illegal arms trading and direct involvement in the black economy have led to what is routinely called a criminalized military, and the concept of gangster capitalism is now routine. President Yeltsin's comparison of the Dudayev regime in Chechnya to the Colombian Medellin drug cartel is doubly interesting, both for the use of this analogy and for its proximity to the truth. And not for the first time, journalists and novelists are way ahead of social scientists in depicting this world. Le Carre, I think, captures its two features very well. First, the criminal subversion of legitimate politics by international rackets immune from conventional law enforcement. And second, the redeployment of intelligence services from Cold War operations to policing these new forms of criminality. The first feature, the operations themselves, by definition is less visible, coming to attention only through events such as the BCCL collapse. The second, the shift from conventional political threats to crime control, the shift from policing national security to policing domestic insecurity, is open knowledge. Three examples, and I think it's that shift from the cult of domestic, the cult of national security to the cult of internal insecurity, which is significant. Three random examples. The director of MI5 in Britain regularly makes public statements about the need to expand the agency's role into areas that are now the responsibility of the police. It wants new legislation to allow it to deal with drug trafficking, money laundering, computer hacking, organized crime, and even animal rights groups. In Germany, new laws have already expanded the internal operations of the security services and transferred political status strategies to domestic crime. In September 1994, the Bundestag created a new role for the German Foreign Secret Services, the BND, in the fight against secret crime, the fight against serious crimes such as terrorism, arms, and drug trafficking. Standard legal restrictions on the police would not apply. The Interior Minister, Manfred Kantner, announced that these new laws were needed because the issue was, and an interesting quote, the issue was, no longer the protection of citizens against the authoritarian state of the 19th century, but against a parallel society of crime today, unquote. A third example, in post-communist countries, former state officials, including and especially the most discredited apparatchiks from the old regime, now openly work for private security companies or sell arms on the commercial market. All this adds up to an interesting picture. The combination of vast profit, total immorality, and anachronistic law enforcement could lead to essentially criminal operations based on drugs and arms, influencing international relations, creating dependencies in national economies, and shaping the internal affairs of states, particularly degenerate states. Crimes of the state again. With the collapse of the certainties of Marxism, liberal progressivism, and the Cold War, universal human rights has become arguably the only surviving meta-narrative. In the New World Order, traditional conflicts between nations remain, but are increasingly overshadowed by internal state terror and ethnic, nationalist, and religious conflicts, resulting in atrocities of unimaginable proportions. Eric Hobsbawm, in his powerful recent essay, Barbarism, A User's Guide, has traced the chronology of today's barbarism as a disruption of the moral rules through which societies regulate their internal social relations and a reversal of the Enlightenment project of finding universal social rules. How do we describe the events of Rwanda and Burundi, the former Yugoslavia, the Caucasus, Haiti, Colombia, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, large sections of West Africa, Sri Lanka, and elsewhere? Theological language of evil and the pictorial language of barbarism, horror, and atrocity have been translated into the bland legalistic terminology of human rights violations. This does sound blander. Instead of thou shalt not kill, we have thou shalt not violate Article 14B of the Convention. But at least all this offers some institutional safeguards, enforcement, and the possibility of prevention. These mechanisms have traditionally been applied to governments, but the term human rights violations, as we know, is broader than the term crimes of the state, including both atrocities committed by armed oppositional groups and those resulting from the breakdown of the government monopoly on violence. Not that these divisions are always clear. The killing of street children and other social undesirables in Brazil and Colombia, for example, may be the responsibility of drug barons, gangs, hired mercenaries, or shadowy vigilante groups directly connected to the police or the army. In Colombia, 1993, death squads of wayward police officers killed some 2,200 disposables, abandoned street children living as petty thieves, prostitutes, addicts, and beggars. Neighborhood cleanup squads, often hired by local business for what is called social cleansing, post notices inviting the community to join in the funeral parade for dead delinquents that will be held. Atrocities committed by states against their own citizens are now routinely described as criminal. Take one example, political killings. Over the last 20 years, millions of people have been murdered or disappeared without trace in Iraq, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Uganda, Burundi, Chad, Indonesia, Guatemala, Peru, the Philippines. They were not victims of war, but their own governments. And human rights reports about these events are now routinely phrased in the language of crime and punishment. Terms like license to kill or the state as a serial killer are used for dramatic effect. Now, all this raises many worrying questions, and again, just a few examples, three. First, what is the moral enterprise behind this new human rights movement? The old criminalization, the type we always studied, derived from middle-class morality and the protection of the interests of capital and the state. But the new criminalization comes from progressive forces, feminism, the environmental movement, consumers, animal welfare, the human rights movement itself. The very social forces which in the 60s were so critical of Leviathan, which argued for decriminalization, have now taken as their success the creation of new laws. Why has criminalization become the preferred model to protect cherished values, especially the cherished values of groups that describe themselves as progressive? How have slogans such as abuses of power come from the radical margins of the 60s into the political mainstream? Secondly, what is actually gained by reframing political events in the language of law and crime? In February this year, at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, an official joint declaration was carefully worded to describe what happened as, quotes, the greatest crime of the 20th century. In 1992, the United Nations Security Council actually had a vote designating, that this is the formal phrase, systematic rape in the former Yugoslavia as a crime against humanity. Now, what does all this renaming imply? What have we gained by this cognitive displacement of political events into the language of crime and punishment? What are the implications, for example, of making denial of the Holocaust into a criminal offense? And this leads to the third question. How appropriate is the punitive law model to resolving these political conflicts and making governments responsible for their actions? This question is raised in two very dramatic recent examples. First, there's the whole justice and transition debate. Should societies going through democratization, South Africa, Eastern Europe, former juntas in Latin America, confront the human rights violations committed by their previous regimes by putting individual perpetrators on trial? It's by no means obvious, as students of all these cases have shown, that the criminal law model can or should be applied. Second, there's now the tribunal dealing with atrocities committed in the former Yugoslavia. Although there were precedents in the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials, this is the first truly international criminal jurisdiction to reproduce all the features of an ordinary criminal justice process: codification of offenses, provision of due process, a victim and witness unit, the detention unit at Hague for inmates. The tribunal's first report, a fascinating document, heralds what it calls a new notion of individual responsibility in international humanitarian law. It refers to what it calls system criminality. It describes its objective as, quote, the elimination of the root causes of international criminality in the country concerned. The suitability of translating such mass political conflict into the criminal justice dialect needs much more serious attention than we give it. It's not just simply a reflex action which can be taken for granted. I now come to what I call the new victimization. In those parts of the world racked by state terror, drug wars, and ethnic nationalist or religious conflict, political violence certainly creates many more victims than regular criminal violence. In our more stable democracies, victims are being discovered in somewhat different ways. I'll list three. First, the same concept of human rights, used to describe massive atrocities, is applied to the more mundane burdens, deprivations, and humiliations of daily life. A 22-stone woman in Chicago sues the state for not providing a large enough cinema seat as a violation of her basic human rights. Men who have been circumcised claim that their basic right to bodily integrity was violated at birth without their consent. And they've even formed a human rights liberation group called RECAP, which in case you didn't think of it, stands for Restore a Complete Penis. Second, the new criminalization has extended the cognitive and legal boundaries of victimization, for example, for women as objects of sexual harassment. And third, the psychotherapeutic empire continues to expand its reach, creating new diagnostic categories of illness as we go: personality disorders, eating disorders, learning disorders, dependency disorders, and other states. Not just repressed memory syndrome, but victims of false repressed memory syndrome. Not just serial killer syndrome, but also women who love men who kill. A book, by the way, of that title appeared in the New York Times bestseller list for several weeks under the category of self-help. Some commentators on what is being called the nation of victims, or by Robert Hughes, the culture of complaint, exaggerate the story, but they're surely correct in noticing that there are profound social consequences in this transfer of private suffering into organized social movements and into public exhibits such as The Confession and Oprah Winfrey and other TV talk shows. For victims, if not for deviants, as we used to think in the 60s, the personal has indeed become political. The culture of victimization emerges from the new identity politics, groups who define themselves only in terms of their special claims to separate identity and suffering. And this trend is given a spurious epistemological dignity by the ethic of multiculturalism. The result of all this is to actually subvert the politics that many of us are still old-fashioned enough to cling on to, a politics based on such old-fashioned Enlightenment meta-narratives as common citizenship and universal rights. I end with perhaps the most disturbing prospect. Our original critique of depoliticization of the political was easy. Cases like the psychiatric labeling of political dissidents in the Soviet Union were so blatant. So too was using the reductivist language of pathology or alienation or anomie or rebellion against parental authority or Oedipal problems to explain away the anti-Vietnam War protests, the counterculture, or the student movement. But developments in the last decade seem to me to call for a revision of this critique. Forms of political conflict have emerged in which ideological conviction is no longer seen as central, and where criminological explanations might indeed make some sense. The most dramatic example has come from the current turmoil of nationalist conflicts and civil wars. As Eric Hobsbawm suggests, these conflicts are neither primarily ideological nor the reemergence of primordial forces long suppressed by communism or Western universalism. They are a response to what he sees as a double collapse: the collapse of political order as represented by functioning states, and the crumbling of the old framework of social relations which stand guard against Durkheim and me. That's Hobsbawm's words. The results are vividly illustrated in journalistic reports such as Robert Kaplan's on countries mainly in West Africa, where lawlessness and crime, not political rebellion or experiments with democracy, are the most significant features of an utterly destroyed social fabric. The picture is frightening. Endemic disease, AIDS, overpopulation, scarcity of resources, refugee movements, erosion of government authority, renegade armies, private security companies, drug cartels. The prospect worse than a coup is an anarchic explosion of criminal violence. Again, remember the Miami Vice pistol sold in the gun boutique in Warsaw. The iconography comes from American crime. The most violent slum in Abidjan is called Chicago. The military historian Martin von Krefeld traces what he calls a transformation of war. For the Chetniks of Serbia, the Technicals in Somalia, the Tonton Macoutes in Haiti, war is not primarily fought by nation states in the name of ideology. And under these conditions, urban crime, to quote von Krefeld, may develop into low intensity conflict by coalescing along racial, religious, social, and political lines. Once the, and again quoting, using von Krefeld's words, once the legal monopoly of armed force, long claimed by the state, is wrested out of its hands, existing distinctions between war and crime will break down. So low intensity war turns into high intensity crime. And for many people, violence is indeed a form of liberation, close to what Fanon meant when we used to quote him 30 years ago, but without the choice that he celebrated. Who are these people? I deliberately take one description from Eric Hobsbawm, precisely because it was his books on bandits and primitive rebels that so influenced us 25, 30 years ago to find the hidden politics of crime, banditry as primitive social protest. Now, observers like Hobsbawm are doing exactly the opposite, describing politics in criminological language. The protagonists make up, I quote Hobsbawm, a typical contemporary form of the dangerous classes, namely deracinated young males between the age of puberty and marriage, for whom no accepted or effective rules and limits of behavior exist any longer, not even the accepted rules of violence in a traditional society of macho fighters. And recent descriptions by political journalists such as Kapuscinski and Michael Ignatieff make exactly the same point. Large portions of the former Yugoslavia, writes Ignatieff in his recent book Blood and Nationalism, are now ruled by figures that have not been seen in Europe since the late medieval times, the warlord. He describes the warlords of Serbia and Croatia variously as bandits, criminals, and serial killers, wandering in a feudal landscape with their leather jackets, their postmodern apparatus of car phones, and their exquisite personal weaponry, supplied, of course, by John le Carré's villains. And their followers, influenced by the worst refuse of Western pop culture and ancient hatreds, are described by Ignatieff in terms such as adolescent lust or hoodlums. Now, of course, they are nationalists, but their convictions are uninteresting. They are technicians of violence rather than ideologues. Nationalism is a vocabulary of self-exoneration. Atrocities are compelled by fear, paranoia, and the tragic necessity of reprisal. There's no brutality which cannot be justified if the words nation, people, rights, and freedom are used. Now, this explanation doesn't expunge political history, but it places it in context. Nationalist violence offers young, marginalized, unemployable males, remember the old objects of criminological theory for so many decades, an escape from the mediocrity and boredom of backward societies dislocated by modernization. They assert their masculinity, entering into a mythic realm of history, intoxicated by destruction and power. As the state monopoly of violence breaks down, the resulting chaos offers young men running the gun culture of the checkpoints what Ignatieff calls the chance of entering an erotic paradise of the all is permitted. And even away from the roadblocks, banditry, and visible warfare of these parts of the world, similar theoretical contours appear. Germany, writes Ignatieff, is struggling to contain ethnic nationalism in its modern European form, the white racist youth gang. He interviews a skinhead in Leipzig. If he were in Los Angeles or Liverpool, Ignatieff writes, he would be just another teenage gang leader. The nightmare of the new Germany is that its teenage gangs talk politics. But are attacks on foreigners by racist skinheads events that belong naturally to politics and take on a criminal guise, or are they primarily locatable in criminological terms and only secondarily take on a political guise? Now, of course, that question is nonsense. Studies of racist skinhead groups in Germany must deal both with ideology, racist beliefs, links with organized neo-Nazis, and the subculture of violence, male chauvinism, and cruel entertainment of dislocated young men. The same applies to equivalent groups elsewhere. To explain the rioting of English football fans, football hooliganism in Dublin in February 1995, how much weight should be assigned to traditional models of subcultural delinquency, and how much to the racism, the connections with fascist groups such as the shadowy Combat 17, or their chance of no surrender to the IRA, or to take contemporary terrorism, a subject I've not even touched upon. When does ideology shade into pathology? 1 week's media commentary on two events, the Oklahoma bombing and the Tokyo underground gassing, consisted entirely of variants of the one question: how much is criminal, how much is political? Now, these questions, of course, make no sense posed in that way. But others must be posed, which don't rely on the touching conception of political ideology that informed the culture of the 60s. Voluntaristic personal conversions, rational choices wholly disembodied from the social. For grasping today's political barbarism, the language of the sociology of crime may be uncomfortably more useful than we would like to think. And in neither language does the new rational free market actor make any sense at all. I now come to some sort of conclusion in my last 2 minutes. Now, it would be banal to conclude merely that the boundaries between crime and politics are now more complex than criminologists imagined 30 years ago. The question is what to make of this complexity. One answer is suggested by the deconstructionist and postmodernist theories that have so seduced the intellectual avant-garde over this period. For them, crime and politics are always to be placed in inverted commas, to be seen not as terms depicting any identifiable object, but as free-floating signifiers capable of infinite transferability from one realm to the other. All we can study is the construction of discourses about crime and politics. Now, this solution is aesthetically very appealing, and it can be carried quite far enough perhaps to make my two lists redundant or at least interchangeable. It leaves little room, though, to understand the substance of those shifts that I've been talking about, such as the politicization of the crime issue or the criminalization of ethnic nationalist violence. And it leaves any normative or value questions even further from reach. In analytical terms, our original enterprise of looking for the links between crime and politics was justified. But do we really want a social order where there's no distinction between the two? The atrocities that have become the daily life for so many people in so many parts of the world are an appalling expression of precisely the obliteration of any distinction between political dispute and criminal violence. For these countries, the remote prospect of democracy relies on a radical separation of crime and politics. And this is surely one way of expressing the old ideal of civil society. And in our own more prosperous and stable social democracies, although the stakes are usually lower, identity rather than life or death, more of a separation between private and public lives might also be desirable. Why should self-understanding, identity, and meaning even be public issues? Habermas is right. I quote, "The state is not a religion, and so it has not to give meaning and identity to the citizenry by means of nationalism, patriotism, or anything else." And the cult of the personal is political. Outings, intrusions into privacy, the moral Olympic games between competitors, claiming superior status for their particular psychic suffering and victimization. All this is not really a very promising basis for any public debate about democracy and social justice. We were right then to follow Metz's injunction not to separate the study of crime from the workings and theory of the state. But a world in which crime and politics become indistinguishable is, as they say, something else. Thanks.
Thank you very much for such a magisterial lecture. I almost tempted to say characteristically magisterial. The other thought that was going through my mind was that at the London School of Economics, Stan has succeeded in crowning a new discipline as the dismal science. Criminology, it seems to me, is now occupies that position. I'd like to invite you all to an informal reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor. There are known to most of you, but if not, look about for somebody who seems to know the place and follow him or her. Thank you.